On the Teacher's Life podcast today, we have Pam Allen. Pam Allen is the executive director of Lit Life, and she is also the founding director of Books for Boys, which is a literacy initiative at the Children's Village, a residential treatment center for and school for at-risk boys ages 6 through 21. And Pam is the recipient of the James Patterson Page Turner Award for excellence in bringing literacy to underserved populations. And she also recently received a Disney Points of Light Foundation Award for her work bringing books and literacy to children. And in May 2007, the Children's Village presented Pam with its Legacy of Service Award for her tireless efforts to bring the magic of books and reading and companionship to kids whose path through life has been very hard. Pam, welcome to the Teacher's Eye podcast, and thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Bobby.
For those listeners that don't know what Lit Life is, could you tell us a little bit about it and maybe what its mission is?
Yeah, Lit Life, I founded Lit Life 6 years ago to bring really high-quality teacher training to teachers interested in furthering the literacy of their students, grades K through 12. And it's an organization that is about teaching, about the dignity of teaching, about the beauty of teaching, and about literacy itself and the empowerment possibilities inherent in giving all kids access to books, to texts, and also to teachers who really can are masters of their craft.
Now, me being that very impressive bio, the one thing that sticks out to me and the thing I probably know the least about is books for boys. Now, I'm a male teacher, and I'm consistently trying to bring the love of reading to boys in my own classroom, and I grew up not enjoying reading at all. Like, literally, I read for enjoyment one book from grades 4 through 12, and that was it. It wasn't until college I got into it, so I'm very interested in what Books for Boys is all about, and could you tell us a little bit about what it is?
Yeah, I actually was working at an organization called Children's Village, which is a residential treatment center for vulnerable kids coming from New York City's foster care system. There are 300 boys who live on campus, and I was actually, as in my role as a Lit Life leader and consultant, I was working with the teachers there, and one day one of the boys asked me to come back and visit him in the cottage where he lived. And when I arrived at his cottage, I looked around and I realized that there wasn't really a sense of a reading environment there. I think, you know, the campus thought about a lot and takes care of the boys in a lot of really important ways. They're very fragile, and they're coming from really often abusive situations, and so they're there for their own, in many cases, their own protection. But what I noticed was that from my point of view as a literacy educator, there weren't enough books there. I knew that access was really critical to create a reading culture, and also just the sense of being surrounded by books and surrounded by the sound of a read-aloud, of literature being read to kids. So I started just organically to start bringing books to the campus, and very shortly realized that something was happening, that there was an energy there, and asked friends and family and teachers and students and other schools to help me collect books to bring to Children's Village, as well as volunteers to come to the village to read aloud to the kids, because I had this kind of gut feeling that if what they missed as very young children was the sound of that the sound of beautiful literature, could we repair that gap by reading aloud to even the older boys on campus, and what, if anything, would that do to their sense of themselves as readers? And that was really the first big question I asked myself. And the second big question I asked was, being that there's only boys here, which is kind of an interesting commentary on the state of urban education, why we're so many boys are falling through the cracks or in need of urgent help or going into crisis, really. So many more boys than girls in our system. I started to also think about what are the read-alouds and what are the books I can put in the boys' hands that will help them feel like readers. And I really noticed that in terms of your question about the boys in your classroom and as a male teacher, your perspective too, I noticed that there really was a difference in what I was choosing to read to my daughters and my students who were girls in my classrooms, and this community of all boys, the Children's Village, and I realized that I too could be learning about gender and about what really would interest boys as readers. So two things that I found out and I learned from the boys at Children's Village, and I'm so grateful for their teachings, is that one is that access to books and access to voices reading books to children is the greatest bridge maker of all time. Boys who'd been very resistant to literacy and really kind of isolated within their own anger and their own very, very lonely place would really melt when we read them books like Where the Wild Things Are and The Chronicles of Narnia and Harry Potter and authors like Walter Dean Myers and Langston Hughes and oh, so many great writers who, in spirit and sometimes in actuality, for example, we did have Walter Dean Myers visit us there. What a blessing that was. But in actuality and in the essence of their books helped us break down so many barriers between the boys and their vision of themselves as readers. They began identifying themselves as readers because they fell into the world of books. And then the second piece of that was just learning or asking the question, like, do boys read differently? Is there something that's perhaps societally based or even just gender-based from birth that would create a different kind of a reader as a boy? I still grapple with those questions. I'm not sure I'll ever have the answers, but I will say that one thing I noticed about is that because there are so many women in this profession, we tend to read a lot of fiction to our kids in classrooms, and I noticed that boys do love nonfiction. They love the idea of browsing books, looking at pictures, looking at facts, looking at information and kind of going from back to front, not necessarily from front to back. And I noticed also that the boys really like books that have a kind of a multi-sensory approach, like they love graphic novels and books like The Invention of Hugo Cabret that have a lot of art in them, or even the I Spy books that mix graphic design with text. And I also think that those books can do a lot for girls, too. I think, you know, one of the things that's great is that we influence each other as men and women, as boys and girls, and it's really pushed me to a new understanding of how we value reading and what we call reading, because I think sometimes as women teachers we'll say, you know, reading is when you read a novel, but I actually don't agree. I think reading can be reading the internet, reading a comic book, but we have to value that as a reading experience.
Well, I remember being in school, and the main things I remember is the first vivid memory I have is sitting in this little cubicle room that they had outside the regular classroom, and they would have a tape recorder there, and they'd give me like just this little book, and they'd press record and have a stopwatch and then start, and that was my main memory of reading. And then I just so appreciate the fact that you took notice of this, first of all, and then actually did something wonderful like this, because I never had anybody, it seemed, and not even in my own home, that really stressed how just fun books can be and how wonderful they are and all the different genres. I was just clueless until I literally was in high school, and I still didn't get into it. So it really put me back a lot, and I missed out, I felt, on a lot of things. So, I mean, what you did with that is just amazing. So,
thank you. And I've heard that from a lot of men. I mean, I do, as you know, being just thinking about books for boys has brought forward a lot of stories from men saying that very same thing. And I think that just one more piece of that is the idea of being mentored or seeing men as reading role models for boys. You know, watching, I think that idea that you know, as men, I think that to take that on, that role as, you know what, I am someone who carries a book around. I'm someone who reads a lot, you know, everything from the newspaper to that, you know, book about Abraham Lincoln or the comics I like or fiction. But I noticed what I found is that, you know, boys will often tell me they don't really have that many people in their readers, and if they do, they tend to perhaps be more often women than men. So I think it's also the responsibility, the obligation of, male members of our society to actually really be very public in their reading lives, so that young men can see that how valuable it really is.
Yeah, that's just wonderful. And besides bringing this love of literacy to New York City boys, I understand that you recently brought the ideas of lit life to Africa, which I just find amazing and would love to hear about. And so what was the main goal that you had in traveling to Kenya, where you went, and what were some of the experiences and reflections you took away from that trip?
Yeah, we really feel very lucky to have made such a journey. We launched Lit World this January and prepared for many months to visit Kenya and also Liberia. And our mission there was to work with teachers in schools in both countries around the reading, writing work that they would very much like to do and wanted us to help them do. And our goals were to connect with teachers there and to learn from them in terms of understanding their communities, what would be most needed, in what ways we could support their work, and also in return, in what ways they could, help us to further our thinking about the teaching of reading and writing, that we hope that the ideas of Lit Life are universal enough so that people all over the world can enjoy them. And we want to make sure for ourselves that we hold ourselves to that standard of, this work is for everybody, it's for all kids, and it's for all teachers. And we went to Kenya. We worked with an incredible group of teachers at a school called the Red Rose Primary School in Kibera, which is a slum in Kibera in Kenya. It's a very, very poor area of Kenya. And being it's the size of Central Park, and yet there are nearly 200,000 AIDS orphans living in that location.
Wow.
You can imagine how many children there are and how crowded the schools are there. And a man named Ken Okos started a school. He grew up in Kibera and became a teacher, and education really saved him. He talks a lot about education as a saving force in his life. And he started this Red Rose Primary School to bring that saving grace of education to the students in his school, most of whom are HIV/AIDS orphans. And his teachers are the most dedicated, most wonderful men and women. I was very, very honored to meet them. And we worked together each day, and we wrote stories together, and they told stories, and we told stories, and we looked at language and literacy as a vehicle for inspiring our students, and shared lots of ideas, and left really refreshed. I mean, I know that I was. My heart was full of those teachers and those students, and how seriously the teachers took their own adult learning. They came each day dressed in the most beautiful clothing, and we ate lunch, beautiful lunches together. They took every moment of it. It was a very thoughtful and loving experience, and I know they bring that to their students too. I will always forever be grateful to them for the way they welcomed us into their lives and all the learning that we all did together. But in Kenya, some of the teachers are actually raising the kids who live in the school, who go to the school, and so the idea of what school is takes on a whole new meaning. Mm-hmm. It's really a community center and a community engagement, and a place of great hope for the children who so love to learn. And we hope very much to go back next summer. We're doing our fundraising right now to gain the opportunity to go back and to be there again and to continue the learning. And in fact, other schools in the area heard about us and are hoping to be involved in the learning this summer. So we're very happy to welcome more schools to that. We had another school, Green Pastors, was also involved in the trainings, and they too were lovely, wonderful teachers. They don't have a lot of resources, but they, thanks to Ken and other supporters, they are able to have brand new computers, and we'll be keeping in touch with the teachers via internet this year.
Wow. Yeah, and I'm sure they're just as thrilled and say just as wonderful things about your organization going over there. I can't imagine what a great experience that was for them to have you. And I can't imagine how excited they are that you might be going back. So.
Yeah, that's really the great thing too, because I think in sometimes people, there's a lot of people that come and go, and our commitment is really to go back and to keep the learning, grow the learning each summer. We were in Liberia as well, and we work with an organization called Youth Action International, and our partner there, Kimmy Weeks, is sponsoring 5 schools there, and his vision is really to provide education for all the children of Liberia and in post-war countries where the children were not able to go to school for several years. So in some cases, we have students in Liberia who are entering kindergarten. They're entering into the small lowest primary school, but they're, 15 and 16 years old. They were child
Wow.
soldiers during the war, and they missed all that school, but yet and still they are so hungry for the school experience that it's worth it to them to go and sit in those tiny chairs and learn the alphabet.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah.
You were talking about some of the writing that you did with the kids and reading, and you before we started the interview, you referenced me to a website called Real eBooks, I think that dot
Yes.
com. Could you explain just real briefly what that is? Because it sounded really cool, and I can't wait to check it out.
Yeah, it's really, really cool. We learned about this from Mike McGuffey, who's the founder of the company, and he's just an amazing guy with a vision. He started this on some Native American reservations out in the West, and basically with this idea that he wanted to figure out how to create the opportunity for kids to write the stories of their lives and to create them in such a way that could be shared by lots of people everywhere. And at the same time, to give kids access to really cheap, really, portable books that could be made for almost less than $1 a book. So he created a software called Real eBooks, and we actually used it when we were in Kenya, as well as our colleague Jonathan Thurston used it in Ghana. And basically, to have Jonathan actually had the kids writing their own books in Ghana. He had a laptop, and really all you need is a laptop and a printer, and the software is free, and you can download it on your computer, and the kids can write their own stories, download photos, download their own pictures to go with their stories, and then they're writing about their lives, but the stories, the books, the little books they make themselves are easy to make, portable to make, portable to share, and as well they can be shared on the internet, so there's virtual libraries. So like your kids, Bobby, could share with kids in Kenya, and my kids here in New York could share with your kids, because it all can also be shared via these virtual libraries on the internet. So
Oh, which is one of the main reasons why we got to teach our kids about the power of the internet. How
oh
powerful is
yeah
that to be able to share your stories with somebody in Africa and vice versa? It's just
oh
amazing.
yeah it really is. And I agree. I think that the word literacy has to include, being really techno literate. That is
Absolutely.
the next big, equity. It's like the way for us all to achieve equity. I mean, we saw that in Africa, that where the internet was coming, there was just a sense of such tremendous hope and communication that we're able to communicate now with the teachers there and with the kids there. And wow, I mean, the impact of that is it's magnificent,
Yeah,
really.
and just and some I often think of the internet and all of the stuff on the internet that kids really have to learn. It's a whole new reading
Yes.
genre that's developing, and it's just so important that kids not only know how to cipher out stuff that is maybe not as good, or it's so amazing how
Yes.
it's almost a totally different skill in some ways.
I think so too. Both about what you just said, which is that kind of like sifting through the stuff to find what has meaning for you, or what perspective the writer had, but also even just what you were saying, the reading experience itself. Like when I think about how I, surf around on the internet, the faster I go, the better I am. So, my skimming, scanning skills have to get stronger and stronger. So when I see kids in class, plowing through these really long books, when in truth, the skills they're going to need as adults, well, that might be one skill they need, but really also I want my kids to be able to get across the internet, like really skate across it really fluidly, you know, and that's a skill in and of itself.
Well, what's just so amazing that the kids are born with it and they're just naturals at it anyway. So if we teach them how to just, they're already so far advanced, you know, that I would assume before I taught second grade, I went in there with some assumption for some reason that they wouldn't be able to do anything. And then they just blow my mind every time they get on a computer. So if we could foster that, who knows what that could lead to, you know?
Yeah, so. I agree. And like the thing is that, you know, just like the truth is that books, I mean, you think about the first, you know, those first books that were written in beautiful, you know, calligraphy, and the earliest books were really only for the wealthy. They were not for the mass market. And I mean, then when books became more mass marketed and the printing press, you know, and that was like the hugest equalizer of all time because it was enabled more people to be literate. The same is true with the internet now. We don't want it to be just for the elite. It has to be for everybody. And I really think so. So,
I can't let you go without talking about one of the main reasons why I wanted to contact you and have you on the show is because you have a book through Scholastic entitled "The Complete Four for Literacy: How to Teach Reading and Writing Through Daily Lessons, Monthly Units, and Year-Long Calendars." And you also have several resources being published, I believe, October 1st, using the ideas in the Complete Four that specifically address each grade level specifically. So could you tell us just briefly what the book is about and maybe what you hope teachers can gain by reading it?
Sure, yeah. Thanks for asking. We're really so proud of the series. It's called The Complete Year. And The Complete Four was my first book that came out last year, and it is the foundational book with this foundational idea about The Complete Four. What we started to realize was, you know, teachers, all of us, we want to know what to do tomorrow. You know, we really want the content of our teaching to be really clear, explicit, easy to use, easy to manage, easy to assess our students, and also really joyous for our kids. And what we noticed was after really years of collecting data from teachers and researching classrooms, we started to realize that virtually everything in the teaching of reading and writing can fit into four categories. Process skills like stamina, fluency, love of reading and writing, building a reading and writing identity, building independence, building collaborative skills is number one. So that's process. Number two is genre. You mentioned earlier that reading the internet is actually a genre in and of itself, and I agree with that. In addition to that, I would add poetry, fiction, and nonfiction, all of which are, you know, you have to kind of get the trick of the genre in order to be able to read through it successfully and to write inside that container. Number three is having strategy skills as a reader and writer. So both input strategies, those comprehension strategies that are critical to good reading, and output strategies, which are the writing skills of craft and structure, and really creating everything from a strong essay to a beautiful sentence. And then finally, the fourth component is grammar and conventions. You know, that never last, but, you know, possibly last but never least, is this idea that people who love to read and write really love grammar and love punctuation, and it's been kind of the forgotten element in a certain way in process classrooms. On the other hand, it's also in a way been taught in a very disconnected kind of way from classrooms where, you know, people are trying to think in a skills-based way, but actually detaching the grammar and conventions piece so much from instruction that our kids can do really well on a spelling test, or they can do really well when they fill in that worksheet, but when they go to write independently, we're still wondering why they're not creating a beautiful sentence or putting a period at the end of that sentence.
Yeah, I just feel that, sorry to cut you off, feel that my own children in my classroom, you know, when I get them at the start of the year, conventions are just a boring sort of fill-in-the-blank worksheet sort of activity as opposed to something that's just aiding the beautiful, you know, piece of writing or piece of reading. It adds so much to it. Just these little marks is just so important. So I appreciated that you had a whole section on that. So,
Yeah, we really feel so happy about it, because we're noticing, we see now in classrooms, our teachers really love to teach grammar now, and they say, before, I didn't like to do it at all, but now I feel so connected to the rest of my instruction. And all four components are equally important and need to be in balance in a year. So the book was really about creating that balance, and then we had a kind of outpouring of requests from teachers saying, could you create books for each grade level that would take us through step by step through a complete 4 year? And we did. We've created a book from a book for every grade level, K through 5, and it gives a sample calendar and units of study for each of those four components, and a chock full of anchor texts, a chock full of great assessment tools and homeworks and resources. And I'm just so pleased to offer these to teachers, because I know that's what teachers have been asking for, and I'm so happy to be able to do that. But I love to see their eyes just light up when they see these books, because they're just chock full.
I think something that's really important, though, that, I mean, in years previous, it feels like I'm planning day to day, and it's just a struggle. I don't feel any sort of connectedness with anything going on. It's just I'm trying to survive. But, you know, you implement a nice plan, and so you can see the whole thing. I think not only is it important for teachers and make it more enjoyable to teach, but something that you said, it's more joyous for kids as well, when there's that connectedness and it makes more sense to them, and they are actually enjoying it more too if you're doing a good job. So.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, the idea of having a flexible framework that you both have a plan, but you know that, you know, when there's a rainbow outside the window or something that you want to just jump up and see with your kids, that curriculum is going to bend for you in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I really believe in that, because the thing that I value above all else is, you know, the voices of kids and the voice of the teacher, and I want to feel that in my curriculum. At the same time, I think people do like to have a plan. They like to know, like, what comes next, and they feel comfortable with that. And so, if, you know, I feel, you know, creating a plan that has some bend in it and some give in it, so if you have a special thing that you like to tuck in or things that you like to do, that I hope these books, and I feel that they will feel that way for people, that you belong in those books. You
well,
know?
I've read the complete four book, and I just really appreciated it and thought it was great. And I'm really looking forward to the books that are coming out for each individual grade. And it says, I think on Amazon or something, I saw that it was October 1st, but it being, what, September 15th right now, they can actually go to your website and get it early. Is that
correct?
Yeah,
they can. You know, Scholastic did us a huge favor, and because we have a lot of schools in our regions who had heard about the books really early and said they wanted them as soon as possible. So they've given us the opportunity to have people listening to this podcast get access to the books a little bit earlier. If you want to go on to our website at litlifeinfo.com, there's a way to order the books right there. And then, of course, October 1st, they'll be available from Scholastic and Amazon as well.
That's great. It's definitely a resource I'm going to check out definitely think others should check out. If you're a teacher of reading and writing at any grade, it would be nice to have. So, but Pam, there's a segment of the show here on the Teacher's Life called the Story of the Day, and this is a part of the show where a story is told concerning life in a classroom. I couldn't think of a better person to tell a story as somebody who's been to Kenya and back. We would love a story of the day from a classroom in Kenya if you have one.
Oh, thanks so much. I'm happy to tell a story. I'm going to actually tell you a little story from a school in Liberia, because it really struck me when you asked about the story of the day. That this is what really struck me. I arrived to do a teacher training session there on a Saturday morning, because that was the day that was actually one of the only days we had to tuck in our schedule. And we asked the teachers if it would be all right with them if we came on a Saturday, and they said, we will be there. And when we arrived first thing in the morning, not only were the teachers there, but all the students, this was their summer vacation, but they were all there too. And they were in their uniforms. They had heard that we were coming from all over the village, and they were so excited to have a visitor to their school that they put their uniforms on and they came over. Some of them walked for several miles, I think, to see us at the school. And when we got there, the classrooms weren't really open at that time because we were going to be doing our teacher training session. There was just one classroom open, but there were about 100 students there. And we gathered together in the outdoor area. There's like a dirt area around, just around the front of the school. And one of the teachers said to me, "Oh, I would like to, what could you do with our students? Because we don't have a lot of resources or materials here. We don't really have any books. We don't really have any chalk. And we have so many children in our classrooms. What would be the one thing that we could do with them that would help them become readers and writers?" So we stood out there in this dirt area, in this dirt field, and I looked at the children all waiting there, and the teachers all waiting for me to say something that would help them, to help them to think about themselves as readers and writers. And I was, you know, humbled in that moment by the fact that these children had come in their uniforms, and the idea that, you know, being there is probably almost the biggest battle of all, is getting there and being there, and that's what everyone was. So I took the hands of the children around me, and I said, "For me, although my voice isn't that good, I do love to sing, and I think singing and play has so much to do with literacy, so I'm going to teach you all the hokey pokey." So we started to do the hokey pokey, putting your left foot in and your left foot out, and in about 2 seconds, all these very smart children figured out that game. And before long, we were spinning around in that dirt circle together, and I looked around as everyone went spinning by me, and I thought about, you know, what is education really? There's people that have nothing, and and do so much, it's so hard for them to get to the place to have something. But when you think about what it means to have nothing or to have something, it's all relative, because in that moment I felt that we all had everything. So that would be my story of the day.
Wonderful story. We have one last question for you before we let you go. We really appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule to join us. So if you had to respond with just a word or a phrase that would sum up for all the listeners what the word teacher means to you, what would that be?
Well, I thank you for that question, because that's a great, great question. The first word that comes to my mind about what the word teacher means would be learner. And I really think that I hope for the whole of my life that I will remain open as a teacher to the potential in myself to be a learner from my students, from my colleagues, from my fellow teachers. And when I meet teachers in classrooms, the teachers that have the most profound effect on their students and the most profound effect on me personally, as someone who's been in hundreds of classrooms and seen lots of different things, I think that the teachers that are most, I think most profoundly affect my view of that word and of the role of a teacher are those who are the most open to their students and the most open to that idea of themselves as being a learner. There's a very old story that I can't remember where it comes from, but it's a question of a sage person who asks the question, who is the teacher and who is the student? And I think that's just, it's such a great question, because it's really, I would say the most timeless thing is really, am I the teacher or am I the student? And I think any teacher that asks that question, any teacher that thinks of themselves, of herself or himself, as a lifelong learner, is going to convey that spirit to their students, and that counts for everything.
Well, Pam, we just very much appreciate you coming on the show. Best of luck with your work in New York City and all over the country, and with your books coming out. And I'm hoping, and I'm sure the people in Africa are hoping, that you can go back there. So thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Bobby. Thanks so much for having me.
That's a cool lady there. Her name is Pam Allen, and she called us from New York City. If you want some more info on Lit Life, visit litlifeinfo.com or litworld.org. If you want to check out that Real eBooks site, got to do it. It's pretty cool. I'm definitely going to use it. realebooks.com. If you want links to the wonderful gentleman in Africa she was talking about, childrenofkibera.org. Kibera is spelled K-I-B-E-R-A. And Kimmy Weeks in Liberia at youthactioninternational.org. You can visit the blog site. There'll be links to all of those and much more at the teacherslifeblog.blogspot.com. You can visit the podcast page at theteacherslife.podomatic.com. And you can come join us on the Ning group, theteacherslifenation.ning.com. And please remember, if you have something wonderful to say, or even something average to say, please call the hotline 623-239-4108 and share your thoughts. We would absolutely love them. You guys have a really good week, and take it easy, okay? Bye.